My name is Dee Bechtel, and this is a session called The Christian in Politics. Subtitle, What is a Nice Person Like You Doing in a Place Like This? I want you to interrupt as I go along. Don't consider this as a lecture with time for questions afterwards. Consider this a discussion, and just hop in whenever you feel you have something to say or you want to ask a question. My general feeling is that a Christian in politics is, well, in politics anyway, is someplace most Christians don't want to be, because politicians are classed right in there with used car salespeople and lawyers who are considered shysters and all those kind of people that we don't trust and we're pretty fearful of in terms of turning any control over to these people. So I want you to know right off that I'm a politician. I have run for state representative and lost, but will probably run for elective office again because I feel it's important that we have as many Christians working within the political scheme as possible. The first time I considered that question was when I was, even though I've got my Presbyterian shirt on here, I was sojourning with the Lutherans for a while with an LCA congregation, and there was a discussion group about Christians in politics, I assume using some material that was at that time put out by the LCA. I don't know if any of you remember that or were involved in discussion groups about that. That was about 10 or 11 years ago, as I recall. Anyway, in that discussion group was a person who was a member of that church who was then serving as the state representative from that area. And it was apparent to me that he took very deeply his concern about his responsibility being a Christian person and being a state representative, because there were lots of questions that he had to decide and some oftentimes compromises that he had to make, weighing off against his own personal beliefs and his own personal convictions, weighed as against what was necessary to keep him in office. And that was a day-by-day kind of a tension that he felt. And it was apparent from what he said in that discussion group that that was a very difficult thing for him to do. And I really came out of that discussion group respecting him a great deal, and still do. Because it was the tension, as I understand it, that he felt was, do I vote on this issue according to my own personal conscience, something that I know is right for me, or do I vote as the people in my district would want me to vote so that I can return to the legislature or I can keep serving as a state representative so that I can be there to vote on some other vote that may be more important. And so it was a constant weighing process then of how important is this? How strong are my personal beliefs, my personal ethics on this question, or could I give a little on that in order to be there for a more important vote the next term, or maybe the next vote in the session. That became a very difficult job, and he served, I think, 3 or 4 terms. We have 2-year terms in the state legislature for state representatives in Oregon, and then decided that tension was so excruciating for him that he needed to find some other way to serve. But that has been my general attitude about what a Christian in politics ought to be. I know how excruciating those choices must have been for him, but that's the importance of it. It's important that someone is there making those choices and feeling the difficulty of those choices, because if they're not difficult choices, then I'm not sure I want that person representing me. And I know that that's contrary a bit. You know, it's hard for me to say, yes, I want to vote for this person so he can go down there and have a very difficult job. But the other choice may be someone who doesn't take the responsibilities of that office all that seriously and can just vote as the moneyed interest or somebody who is he knows is going to put up a lot of money for his next campaign or those sorts of things. In my opinion, it's clear that we need more Christians in the political realm. We can't just simply say politics is a dirty business, I don't want anything to do with it. Because if we continue to let it be done by those folks who are interested in being in a dirty business because they're somewhat dirty themselves, then we're in trouble, I think, because really we are entrusting the government of our country to people that may not have this kind of high standards that we have. And that's pretty scary when we're talking about nuclear weapons, when we're talking about energy issues or the use of our land or the misuse of our land, when we're talking even on the more local level, you're talking about what kind of crime prevention you have in your own city, those kinds of things. It's pretty important that you have people there, in my opinion, that are really concerned about making those tough ethical choices. And I like to think of politics as one of the other ministries, another ministry that I would like to encourage people to consider. I take very seriously the job by which I earn money and consider that a ministry. And I've been pleased that I've talked to some other people around here at Holden that consider their paid job in that same way. Their job is just not something to earn money. Their job is a way that they can carry out the will of God for their life. And believe it or not, that really is possible to do in politics. It may be more difficult to do in politics, but that is another ministry, as far as I'm concerned, that I would really like to encourage more people to get into and more people to consider as a ministry. I think when we take the attitude that, well, I don't want to have anything to do with politics because either I don't understand it or it's dirty business that I don't want to get involved in, then we're turning the reins, the control, over to people that may not have our best interests at heart. And that's pretty scary stuff, too. But it's like any other ministry. If you stick your neck out, you become a target, or you take a courageous stance, and someone else might decide that that's not what they want, and so therefore then they're going to try to knock you off or to work against you. And so you really have to learn how to be able to do the compromising, be able to trade off your vote on one thing for someone else's vote on an issue that's more important to you. And that oftentimes maybe is what makes the rest of us think that politics is sleazy, because you're not just following a straight and narrow path. But following a straight and narrow path is more and more difficult to do. I have a great deal of admiration for people who have been in politics a long time and still are clearly very ethical and support their Christian faith and proclaim their Christian faith through their political life. One of the national senators from Oregon is named Mark Hatfield, and he is one of those people that I'm tremendously impressed with. He has written several books, one of them entitled Between a Rock and a Hard Place, that really, you know, expresses much of what I'm saying. And he describes specifically some situations that he's been in, some really difficult votes that, in his opinion, have put him between a rock and a hard place because of his personal faith. But he's hung in there, and he has now hung in there long enough in the U.S. Senate so that he has increasing amounts of power, and that's exciting to know that there really is somebody there in a position of power in our government on the national level that takes very seriously his ethical responsibilities. Where the problem that I have more recently And again, I encourage you to jump in if you're disagreeing with what I'm saying, or you have some questions, or you'd like to put in your 2 cents worth, please feel free. I see what to me is a scary thing that's happening on the particularly on the national level, but it kind of filters down to more state level politics as well. There seems to me to be a group of people who say there is one church position, there is one Christian position, and if you disagree with us, you're wrong. And those folks are the ones that are trying to say we must have prayer in the schools, for example, or we can't even consider abortion or birth control, and that is the position. And if you disagree with us, then obviously you're not Christian, or you're not representing your Christian faith. Those people are scary to me. They also get into some of the other issues, for instance, the euthanasia issue that we were discussing last night, that these folks are saying, sustain life at all costs. Their position on the question, if some of you were here at the forum last night, their position on that question, whether to do the heroic measures to continue the life of this man that didn't want the doctors to continue his life, would be life must be sustained. Doctors must do everything they can to continue life, no matter what. And I disagree with that. And I think that my position can be sustained by my Christian faith equally as well as their position can be sustained by their Christian faith as they understand it. And that's okay. We can disagree on ethical issues, we can disagree on political issues, and still be living out our Christian faith. People who say there's only one right answer immediately raise hackles on me. I immediately begin to think they're not looking at the whole question. However, well, I guess where I see these people heading, if indeed the people that I would characterize as the far right would win in some of the positions that they're now supporting on the national level, I think we're getting dangerously close to violating what was set down as one of the principles of our nation when it began, that is the separation of church and state. When the original settlers came to the United States, they came here because they had some disagreements politically and religiously with people in the countries that they came from. And so they very specifically, in my view, set up the Constitution of our United States so that there would not be one controlling church or one controlling viewpoint, religious viewpoint, that would influence the government. And in my view, these people from the far right that are trying to say there must be prayer in school, for example, are really getting very close to that. Now again, I know that there may be people here that disagree, and if there are, say so. My viewpoint, of course, is not the only viewpoint, and the same thing is true for me as for anybody else. If I don't intend to say that there's only one right answer and I've got it, that's as arrogant as the people with whom I disagree. So if we can get a discussion going on that sort of thing, I think that's healthy. That helps us all. Yes?
Well, I'm from Minnesota, and the Republican Party in Minnesota is just about demolished the party leaders because the precinct caucuses were mostly taken over by extremists on religious issues, and then they controlled the delegates to the convention.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, threatening endorsement process for the candidates. I don't think they're that strong in the state that they can elect their position. But you know, the way they're moving, you know, like you say, and I've been involved. I'm chairman of the campaign for my representative, their state representative, and people wouldn't work for me on the committee unless I came right down the line and said that I was solidly against abortion and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It came not, it was just the candidate's position. It was my position. I'm not a candidate. I'm just managing the candidate's campaign.
Hmm.
It puts the candidates in a terrible position, but
yes.
It also creates a situation where people are endorsed not because they're good in Washington or good political strategists, but because they take that narrow position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you see, and some of those candidates are succeeding. And so I think you're concerned about that what the legislation they'll pass, but I think there's a concern of just putting people in the power who aren't really confident to be there.
Yes.
They're there because of a single issue support.
But right, right.
And you have some, well, kind of strange alliances with fundamental Christians, the right, and also, well, Roman Catholics who would traditionally be on the Democratic side, but then the abortion issue, they've crossed over
mm-hmm.
to this group.
Mm-hmm.
So it's had a definite impact on the party structure in the state, for sure.
Yes, right. And I share your feeling about the problem if we elect a candidate who is really a very one-issue-oriented or maybe a few-issue-oriented person. In my view, those people aren't going to be as effective in getting all the other or dealing with all the other legislation because they really haven't informed themselves on the broader issues. They have been so narrowly oriented that, in my opinion, they're not as good legislators just because they don't know how to deal with, or they're not interested in dealing in some cases with the other issues. I agree. Other comments?
Do you think there will have third in schools, or do you think there will be too many different religions to have?
I think it would be very difficult. Well, I guess I am convinced that the people that are very interested in this prayers in the schools issue are not a majority. That's my belief now. Now, I could be proven wrong, but, you know, so on that basis, I don't think that it would pass on a national level. And I think there's enough concern from people who are minority groups. We have, in my opinion, we have been always concerned with letting minority positions at least have, or being courteous to minority positions in this country. And when we, anytime you put prayers in the schools and you put one person in charge of deciding what that prayer is going to be, you're violating somebody's religious rights. Now, we have done things in the schools in the past. For instance, reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. There are some people who have religious objections to reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in the schools, and those students have been allowed not to say the Pledge of Allegiance in their schools. That becomes, in my view, that becomes a little more difficult when you're talking about prayer. You know, what do you do with kids who say, or whose parents have made it clear, no, I don't want my kid participating in this prayer? You stick them out in the hall for a few minutes or something, you know, it gets a little complicated. My view is that prayer is now allowed in schools. Nobody says to my kids that, you know, nobody's preventing my kids from praying as often and in whatever way they like in the schools. And that's true of anyone from any religious category. I think where the problem comes is when you decide there will be this prayer recited that is probably going to step on somebody's toes. So why not just say, you know, if it would come to that, I think the better alternative would be to allow a few minutes of silence or something like that, to let people pray or meditate or not pray, just be silent.
That doesn't work.
You're a teacher?
I was.
Uh-huh. So you've tried that sort of thing in your classroom?
But they did say there's a lot of prayer going on in school, especially at test time.
Let's hope. Yeah. That would be good, I think. Yes.
Could you please comment on what you see as the church's role in providing its members an outlook on political issues?
I think the church has a lot of responsibility in helping to educate our congregations. That would go into some of the things, political issues obviously are the sanctuary issue that I discussed a few nights ago. I think that's an important part of our citizenship, that we be informed. And I think the church has a responsibility to help our people be better citizens. Now, I know that that can get a bit touchy from time to time. You know, obviously, if there are divisions of opinion within a congregation, but I think a way to handle that would be just simply to provide a forum, provide a person, you know, people with diverging views to state their views and have a discussion. People learn a great deal from those kinds of things, and that isn't saying people in this congregation should vote this way, but I think it's really important that we say on Sunday bulletins and all those sorts of things when there are election issues coming up, please vote, because I think that's part of our participation in our governmental system.
Don't most of the synods, or most of the Lutheran church bodies have a man who is the liaison sort of thing? I know for LCA, Chuck Bergstrom writes an article in our Lutheran every issue, and he speaks to different governmental issues, and this would be part of the education.
Mm-hmm.
He has some absolutely fantastic ones on prayer in the school.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know. See, I'm not a Lutheran. So I'm not sure what is the situation in all Lutheran churches, but I think that's a good thing for the church to be doing, in my opinion, because it helps educate us about what some of those issues are. There, yes?
I'm losing my voice. I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying, and I wonder, could you suggest something that we could do to counteract some of this far-right business? Now, Chuck Bergstrom, we come from Washington, and he did an outstanding job on this prayer issue.
Mm-hmm.
Was going to TV talks and writing, write to your senator, your congressman, and so on. Do you have any other suggestions how we might counteract?
Well, continuing to write or to be in touch with your representatives on both the national and the state level, I think, is probably the best and most effective thing that we can do. Some of the other things that we can do, however, are simply to get involved in the political process. Run for office yourself. Run for your local school board if the idea about running for the state representative or for Congress is a bit over your head at the moment. But certainly we need concerned parents or concerned people in the community on school boards, people that are willing to take some of the flack that those positions entail. Be active in your political party, whatever that is. Just participate more fully in the political process, and do so as a concerned Christian when it's appropriate to do that. For instance, in letters to your congressperson or to your representatives on whatever level, make it clear to them that you are a Christian and you believe that the Christian, your faith, dictates this kind of a response, or this is your concern because of your Christian faith. And I think that oftentimes what I see in the media, what I see in the press particularly, is that Christians are identified with these folks on the far right, and it isn't clear, at least in the mass media, that there are other Christian viewpoints that don't agree with the folks on the far right. And so simply making that distinction as often as possible is helpful, in my opinion. I wouldn't want to have a minister in any church that I was involved in tell me how to vote. But I think it's a minister's or the church's in general job to educate the people on the issues. Say, you know, this vote is coming up. We're, you know, offering a forum on this issue to help you understand more about this issue. But in terms of telling me how to vote, I wouldn't appreciate it.
There's also the legal and orders.
That's right. Who are very good
study issues.
That's right. And they put out a lot of material, at least where the places that I'm familiar with. They put out very good analyses of pros and cons on various issues and do a very good job of educating the people.
Mm-hmm. What was the name of that?
League of Women Voters. I was distressed recently, and again, I may be stepping on some toes, but I actually met a person who had this position of the far right and was amazed. This was a woman that I met at church, and so we had lunch, and I was trying to find out from her why it was that she, what the support was, why she believed the way she did. Things like she was adamantly opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment, and I am very much in support of the Equal Rights Amendment. And so what I was trying to do was find out what the basis of her position was. And she started out by saying, well, it's not biblical. She could never go any further than that and tell me why it wasn't biblical. But she had been fed a whole lot of information by people who were in authority, or who she believed, apparently, who just made statements like that. It's not biblical. Well, therefore, you know, therefore, then we ought to be very much against the Equal Rights Amendment. But in our discussion, I discovered that that was a position that, or that position was similar to others that she had. It was just accepting a rhetoric that had been fed to her by some people who make strong statements, and then believing, therefore, that that was true. Some of the things, for example, that she believed were true about the Equal Rights Amendment were that the Equal Rights Amendment would force all women to go to work outside the home, that the Equal Rights Amendment would completely invalidate our system of Social Security, and so that women who hadn't worked outside the home would not get any Social Security benefits. You know, and these are, in my opinion, ridiculous statements, because I don't think anyone has ever contended, well, I take that back, anyone other than the people on the far right are contending that these are realities, that these are what the things that would happen. The things that I'd heard previous to this time about the Equal Rights Amendment is that it would force unisex toilets and that it would force the drafting of women. It may do that. And so however you feel about the draft, in general, my position is that we ought not to be drafting anybody, so therefore maybe if the Equal Rights Amendment did then lead to laws that would say that both men and women should be drafted, that may be a good way of working against the draft itself. That's maybe a pretty far out position for some of you, and if you disagree with that, fine. But what concerned me about my discussion with this woman was that she was so convinced that the Equal Rights Amendment was against anything that she believed in her personal religious faith. And I don't see that it is, but that she had accepted without questioning a lot of statements that were made without really getting into the basis for those statements. And that's the scary part as far as I'm concerned, that if we're accepting what anybody says without questioning it, then I think we're in trouble. I think that's a large part of our responsibility, to really find out, is this statement true? Why, you know, what's the basis for this statement? If you really believe that the ERA will enforce unisex toilets, then why is that true? You know, what basis is there for that belief? I'm not sure she changed her mind any. I can't hold out that much hope. But what I tried to do was continually question her belief. You know, I started out by saying, well, going into the conversation by knowing that I really didn't have any realistic hope of converting her to my way of thinking. That was not one of the possibilities in that situation. But if the best I could do would be to help her question why it was that she believes the way that she does, and help at least suggest to her that there may be another equally valid Christian viewpoint. And I hope I did that much. I'm not sure I can, you know, I don't know, and she'll probably still... Yes, yes, she was courteous and she listened and seemed interested in finding... Oh, another thing that she was firmly convinced of, again, probably because of rhetoric that has been fed to her by the far right, that the National Organization for Women has a great deal of control in our national politics, that they are really dictating policy on the national level. My position was, gee, if they are, why hasn't the ERA passed a long time ago, you know, if they really have that much control? But it seemed like she had a great deal of fear from the National Organization for Women, mostly because, again, she had been fed some pretty serious misinformation. I was relieved that I could tell her that I'm not a member of the National Organization for Women, because I guess that helped her see me not as the enemy. But I was able to tell her that I belong to other groups, that other women's groups in particular, that do support the Equal Rights Amendment, and tried to give her some of the reasons why, in my opinion, they do that. Anyway, it was an educational experience for me, because I really had never before that time talked to someone who was the them in my political views, you know, and I guess it's real easy to get into the us and them kind of thing in politics. But it was interesting to really be sitting across the table from someone who believes as strongly as she does, and I could get some insight as to what some of the basis for her beliefs are, and some of the thinking then that's going on for some of these folks from the far right.
I think that's something that maybe we could do, would be just to get some information out to people. The far right's doing a good job, but they're the only ones getting it out. We had a friend who put on a peace conference, and it was an awful lot of work, but she reached 600 people in doing this, and gave all sides. Wasn't just the peace people there, but gave both sides of the issue, and then let people go out and make up their own mind, and they were simply giving information. And she felt it was just a real successful thing. But you have to put forth an awful lot of work. It took 3 months to get ready for this, and just a terrific amount of work. So if you want something to do and you don't want to run for office, that would be a possibility.
True. Or there are other things, I think, that may have a smaller scale that we could do in each of our churches. For instance, write little blurbs in your church newsletter, if you have one, just giving people information about an issue that is of concern to you. Fred, did you have something you want to say?
Yeah. I want to take the position. I want to take the position that man was created first to be boss over the woman, as a biblical position, right? Arguably. That would be the right wing.
That's right.
That would be the right wing idea. Mm-hmm. The Bible says women were made subservient to men. Adam was created first. Woman sinned first. A lot of that's written in there, okay? It's popping up tomorrow in the Bible study in Ephesians, mm-hmm. a little bit. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's clear, you know, black and white is printed there. Now argue with me, please.
Okay. My understanding is that there are two creation stories.
Excuse me for turning my back.
I understand. I was concerned that you weren't turning your back a few minutes ago. They weren't understanding. My understanding, and... I almost said I'm not a theologian. I think we're all theologians. I have the right to be a theologian, too. I have never been to seminary. Maybe that is a better description. My understanding is that there are two creation stories, and without spending a little time, I'm not sure I can tell you where one begins and one ends, but my understanding is that there are even two names for God in the two creation stories. One is the Yahweh, and one is Elohim, And again, my understanding is that those two words arose at different times in the evolution of this oral tradition that is now set down as what we know as Genesis. So that there were two creation stories that apparently, we might be able to assume, arose at two different times within the oral tradition. One of them says that God created man and then took his rib, etc., and made woman. The other one begins by saying that God created the heavens and earth and goes through this order of creation and then created man and woman at the end of it. Now, again, without taking some time and giving you chapter and verse, but maybe consider that as an option. Go back to your room and read Genesis and read more than the first two chapters and see if you can find some substantiation for that. I think I could if I spent some time, yes.
I like this, devil's advocate here. I don't know, but it's a fair argument, I guess. I have had to deal with lots of right-wing folks in my, you know, and you just don't want to hold them, and I find it real frustrating. But that approach doesn't hold a lot of water, because you can find codes up and down and sideways to support any issue you want to support. And unless you can give me reason rather than quotes to support a position, just telling you that one part of the Bible says this and another part of the Bible says this. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
That, okay.
I try to do, yeah, that's a nice start, but I always try to do a little bit more than that. Yeah, if I'm trying to convince somebody.
Okay. Are you, all right, well then let me continue. The other thing, another thing that I would say.
You're representing. One of the things that happens is that's become a very big issue about the interpretation of the Bible. Mm-hmm. So the person would say, you got the wrong interpretation of the Bible. You're all wrong. And we're back into that same place again.
That's right.
The right wing saying, you're wrong.
That's
and
right.
We're right.
That's right.
Now, with that, you can't really take the Bible and use it against them.
Probably not.
They're not going to listen.
Okay.
Turn off the
interview. Yes. Okay. Well, then
You go on to some other ones. You might find some other Bible passages.
Mm-hmm.
But on the two story of creation, that old fundamental concept of one story of creation, there's a lot of people accept it as one story, and they just ignore and reject the two story idea, and it's done. Your argument is over. You got to find some better things.
Okay, all right. I would really take it into the New Testament then, because next week I hope to be leading one of these sessions on the fact that I believe Christ is a feminist, a far-right radical idea, or a far-out radical idea. The basis for some of that is the fact of Christ's relationship to women, the fact that he did a great deal for instance, he first appeared after he rose to a woman. I mean, but, all right, I'm getting into then the trap that Fred has set me. Basically, I am trying to use scripture to fight the battle that I probably won't be able to win. What it comes down to is the fact that I believe Jesus was a very egalitarian person when he was on earth, and God, the God that I know from the Bible and from my relationships with other people, is a very loving and accepting God. And so therefore I don't have to necessarily believe that the Old Testament is the total end-all and be-all of my relationship with God or my relationship with people around me. I believe that God wants me to be a whole person. And therefore, I don't have to be in subjection to my husband more than my husband is in subjection to God.
I think that there are people who have done all this homework, too, and that if we had
Presbyterians or Lutherans or whatever we are, look to our denomination. There are people who have that information. They have biblical quotes to support them, and they have information that they have spent a lot of time on. And if we would look to our denomination for that information, if they have it available, we'll be glad to send it to us and tell us how to disseminate it through our congregation. I know, being Presbyterians, that we do. And I'm sure the well, you said that they have a real good. And I think that instead of us always looking to the, thinking, well, I can't possibly find sources that are going to prove my point, somebody's already done that for us. And we could get that information and get it out in the churches real easily if we would just write a letter or make a contact.
I guess I think that that isn't the case, though. The people of that persuasion that I have talked to don't argue from a rational basis, but from an emotional one. They take that position because they're threatened, and they feel insecure with the changes that are coming along. And I don't think any rational arguments will be in there at all.
No, I don't mean to argue with them. I mean to give our people our information, to give our congregations our information. The only information they have is the right side, because that's the only one that's being published. But we have a right to publish our information, whatever information we have. And I don't, no, I don't intend to argue with them, because I don't think you can win them either.
Well, and I really think that a large part of my response with this person that I described that I was talking to ought to be, I think God loves you and me anyway. We can disagree on all of the issues, you know, and that doesn't really matter. We can still continue to be members of the same congregation. We can still perhaps have, hopefully, friendly discussions from time to time, but we can agree to disagree. I think that's a valid position to have in our churches.
So we have to have both sides.
True.
And that's, you know, I think that's what's missing for most of us, is that we don't have the other side, because most of us just kind of sit back. I have not written to find out my side.
Mm-hmm.
I know I don't agree with the other side.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I think there are people in the national level of our of our churches that can provide that.
Uh-huh.
Yes, before you, wait, Fred, somebody else.
I just think, you know, in terms of any kind of dialogue, I mean, it's got to come from a logically based, or logically and theologically based argument, position, rather than argumentative point. But rather than being totally centered on bits of scripture, I think the greater idea is, as you talk to, as you expand on your point, as far as I'm concerned, you did a much better job of persuading me. You talked about the overall theology. And, oh, by the way, here are a few things.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's an entirely different story than saying, well, look, Bible says this, this, and this. And I'm a little bit concerned about some of the things that you said. And let me write to find out my position. I don't like writing anybody to find out my position on anything.
Okay. No, that's not what you meant.
Okay, that's misunderstood.
Well, maybe I didn't say it very clearly.
But, I think that this, you know, as far as being educated and finding out what the Bible has to say, but I think any position has to be formulated much more, rather than on a specific bit, on an inclusive knowledge, you know, and as best as we can formulate. Nobody's an expert, and you can't ever be entirely an expert. A more well-rounded approach is much better than something that's stacked on little bits.
Yes, right. I agree. Because, again, we've all heard the statement that you can find Bible verses to support just about any position you could take on a whole wide spectrum of things. That's not the point. The point is, what does our personal relationship with God lead us to believe? And I think
you
that's
have to first find out how some of these issues are formulated.
True.
And what is being brought up before Congress. Find out if, you know, section 14, section
right.
C.
Sure, yeah. We need to delve in that and do some studying on our own. Fred.
I wasn't going to come tonight.
But anyway, that's fine. This is a very interesting subject for me, because I have seen myself move from the far right to the left. And I'm frustrated because I don't know how I can get the far right to understand the other position. And so it's frustrating me very much. The most frustrating thing is to meet women that are saying, women shouldn't become president, women shouldn't become pastors. You know, some of these ideas that are involved, and then they follow on through to what I think is the ERA.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very difficult, because most of the women I'm meeting are on the other side. And still there's enough over here on the right wing that they're helping to support the blocking of this legislation. Involved also with things like equal pay for equal work, or equal pay for work of equal value, and some of these things keep popping up. And, I'm just frustrated just trying to get the idea across. I can argue with men quite easily.
I think you're about to make a sexist remark. I think you're about to make a sexist remark.
I can move over here and I can say, this is my position, and I'll stand up to support it, and I'll pull in. I don't normally go into two stories in Genesis. I found it's not worth it. But I go into the thing, Jesus speaking to the woman at the well and so forth. I also get into things like some of the Old Testament women that served in positions that are the same as, you know, the high prophetic, the judges and so forth. But I really find it frustrating to tell them, you know, why not a woman president? Why not president of the church? Why not a woman pastor?
I really liked I like a phrase that was in a book that I'm reading, I was reading this afternoon, called Christian Feminism, which is an astounding title for some people. They have no idea that, or they think that's a contradiction in terms. Anyway, one of the statements in this book was about the totaled woman. Totaled, past tense.
A-L-E-D?
Yes.
Woman.
That's a takeoff from the total woman, which I think many of us have read. But the idea was that the total woman has probably been totaled mostly by fear. And that's what I see in some of these women that Fred has described, having to do with, you know, I don't think a woman ought to be president of the church or president of the country or a pastor in my church. Let her be a pastor of somebody else's church, please, but not mine. I think it's fear. I think it's fear of responsibility. It's pretty scary to say, I'm going to run for state representative. My ideas, who I am, is out there on the line for people to take pot shots at. And that same thing is true when you're talking about a woman pastor. That person is on the growing edge of social change. And there are going to be a lot of people that are upset about that, mostly because fear of change, in my opinion. And that's what's happening with a lot of these women, in my opinion.
I think what I found the best argument is this, is going back to say to the woman that says, I don't think a woman should be president or pastor, I don't think the ERA is right, and so forth. Ask the woman if she really wants her vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go to the far-out idea and mm-hmm. say, do you really want your vote? Why don't you give the vote only to the men again?
Mm-hmm.
Overstep. What about, you want to constantly go to men doctors? Because many are finding much more comfort in female doctors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, I finally got to a place I go to a woman doctor.
And she turned
it over to her husband. Thank you.
We still have a hangover in this country from the time the country was formed. Women didn't have the vote until 1920. And we are still, you know, have a hangover from that idea.
Yeah. And and it also took women, I mean, the idea of letting women vote began in 1848. It took us approximately 60 years of a whole lot of work by some very dedicated people, most of them women, to get women the vote. And I suspect that some of those women would be saying now to us, hey, why did we work so hard for you if you're not going to do anything more with it than what you have done already? Women have the vote now and a great deal of power at our disposal. I didn't intend for this to be the woman in politics, but as long as we've got there, that's fine with me. We have a lot of power in our vote and in our organizing abilities to organize a lot of political activities. We don't use it. We're afraid of some of that power, in my opinion.
The Christ pattern and the Christ consciousness that comes through the New Testament clearly shows no discrimination insofar as that sexes are concerned in any way, shape, or form. It overrules everything that you might want to find in the Old Testament to justify sexual discrimination, in my opinion.
But the problem is, in my opinion, that the church has taken the Christ pattern, as you refer to it, and warped it back to the old patriarchy. We've allowed men church leaders to dictate to us what we believe. Yes?
I don't know. Maybe this is a little bit off, but in our congregation, the men are forcing the women to take positions because they are not doing it. There are less and less men in our council. There are more and more women all the time, but it seems that the men do not choose to hold these offices for one reason or another.
Is that bad?
No, it's not bad. But I'm saying
that it's a change that's happening.
He says
it's a strange phenomenon that in churches that once men find out that women can do these jobs, they love.
Sure do.
That's good, in my opinion.
Well, yeah.
Go
but
for it.
But I'm not so sure I want an entire church council made of entire women. No. Not that they couldn't run the church as well as a church council made of entire women, but I think they need to be represented at least.
I think that somewhere, it must have been left out of the Bible, that men and women must have agreed on a division of labor that we've forgotten about. And I have said to pastors and to our council that in spite of the fact that I have occasionally given a sermon and that I give talks and I take an active part in the church work, I still feel that we need men behind the pulpit because the more women you put up there and the fewer men that you put up there, we're going to lose the men. We have enough in church now. I think what we need is a good evangelistic drive to get the men back in church, get them into the homes, get them to be heads of the homes, get them to teach the Bible to their families, to take the family and really bring them around. Because what we've had is just the nuclear family, the husband and wife, who do all the in things, and then they have all these in things for the kids, and they run around and doing all these in things. And where is Christianity?
Let me say something outrageous and then we'll go to Vespers. If what you need, what you want is to bring more men into the church, how about a sexy woman pastor?